Hi, Ranjan. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's so nice to be here.
Let's start with maybe a simple but difficult to answer question is how do you define reality? In my perspective, our reality is more a subjective interface, and we're limited by our five senses and how we perceive reality. Tell me a bit more about how you define reality. How do humans play into that? And with the advent of AI, how is our reality changing?
Yeah, so I'm an engineer. I'm sort of a pragmatist. So I'm probably less on the spiritual side, probably. But so I would sort of define reality is, often there's a phrase, perception is reality, people perceive it, it is real. Right, and sometimes people are in denial of a particular thing, but other people are perceiving things, so you have to realize that. So reality is the physical world. Reality might be something you are projecting, and if other people are perceiving it, then that is part of the reality universe that you are part of. Now, there are realities in the mind. Certainly, time travel. How do you do time travel? Well, you go to sleep. So when you're asleep, it's a different reality. We've all sort of gone to sleep and woken up and thought, oh, I've just woken up. I've only been asleep 10 minutes, but actually you've been asleep 8 hours. There's sort of time compression to be able to do things. So part of it is the living reality, awake reality, and then there's the sleeping reality, or what you are thinking about, what the brain is thinking about, and what the brain embodies. And then in between, daydreaming, where you have reality in your mind and you're not sure whether it's possible. So when you're in inventing, when you're in an invention space, when you're trying to think of new ideas or solutions to the problem, you're simulating reality in your mind. So a long-winded answer, but that's maybe my answer to that, your question.
Thank you. And how does consciousness fit into this framework of reality where you're breaking reality down into sleeping reality, daydreaming reality, and awake reality? Is the thought process there that there are different levels of consciousness, which we know from anesthesia, but we tend to frame the different levels of consciousness in terms of how much input we perceive and how sedated we are. Talk to me a bit about consciousness. How does reality and or the three different subtypes of reality play into consciousness?
Right, yeah. So thousands of people for thousands of years have been trying to think about what is consciousness. I feel myself an amateur in this, but I don't feel myself unwilling to opine on this. What is consciousness? People have been trying to figure that out for a long time from many different disciplines. Stanislas Dehaene in Paris. He talked about three types of consciousness. Subtype one, where you can think of it as the autonomous consciousness, where you're doing things without even knowing it. You're breathing, you're blinking your eyes without even knowing that you're doing it. Then there's consciousness type two, where you have a more deliberate action points on what you're thinking about from an internal basis. So I am talking, you are talking, we're doing that deliberately. And there's consciousness type two, where which is sorry, type three, where you're looking at consciousness where you are with respect to your environment and to the rest of the world. So that's one field of sort of definition of what consciousness is. There are other ideas. Roger Penrose at Oxford, he got the Nobel Prize, but not for this. He got it for physics. No, he thinks that consciousness is really embodied by quantum forces in the molecular makeup in your cells in your brain, and those forces are really the embodiment of consciousness. And maybe that's why you get love at first sight. Maybe you get tiny, 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 tiny little forces going back and forth, but they're so infinitesimal, they're really not really measurable by you and I, but maybe they're there. And then there's other people who think, well, one of the reasons it's difficult to define is it's like a fundamental, like time and space. It's like asking a blind person to describe what color is. It's just a fundamental sort of mode where you can't define it in other fields. You have to, it is a field by itself. And so, people have tried to study the brain. Francis Crick and Christoph Koch. Francis Crick discovered DNA, of course, but in the last in his latter part of life, started looking at the brain, started looking to find pieces of the brain that maybe that embodied awareness and self-awareness in the brain. So people, I don't think people know. I don't know the answer. I'm not clever enough, above my pay grade. But this is what I'm thinking of, that consciousness is kind of a fundamental, that as such it's going to be difficult to define, and that's why it's maybe difficult for a machine to have consciousness, because it needs to be attached to something living. It needs to be embodied. And if you can't have it attached to cells that are living, then maybe it's going to be difficult to get real consciousness that the living beings think about. But it's possible to have biosilicon hybrids in semiconductor architectures, where maybe you do have some living components where things grow and add on, versus a silicon chip which is fixed. It may be reprogrammable, a chip, so-called EEPROM, or a application-specific circuit that may be specific for a particular application. They can be put together just like your laptop. You can program it in different things, but it doesn't live; it's fixed. So I think consciousness needs to be connected to something. If we all, unfortunately, there are some people who have locked-in syndrome, where they can think perfectly, but they can't move, can't move a muscle, can't speak. Maybe they can blink their eyes, but they can think perfectly. Obviously, they're much more limited in what they can do. So really, computers are like that. They can't move. They can't, often they see at our behest, they listen at our behest, they can't control when they see and not see. And so if we start to get robotics, robots, where the machine can actually move around and sense things, maybe you get a stronger consciousness framework that living beings actually have. So again, I'm sorry about my long-winded answer. It's probably an engineering-focused answer on what consciousness might make up of.
Let's go a bit deeper here, and I will push back a little bit.
Please do.
If we break down consciousness into the three core components or the three types of consciousness being involuntary or autonomous processes, or reflexes or breathing, outputs like verbal communication, such as us talking or us communicating, and inputs such as hearing and feeling and the senses we have, one could, and I suppose I'm making this argument, that machines can possess those three components. Machines have involuntary or autonomous processes. Programs are running, computers are running, there's things happening in the background that are always happening. Now with AI, machines have outputs as well. They communicate with us. And they're able to take input. The ChatGPT is a very simple example. You can talk to it. It takes, digests that input, does whatever it does with it, and it gives an output. So by that definition, why does it need to be a carbon life form? Why can't machines possess consciousness? And maybe as you said, we just cannot define consciousness, and the only thing we know is you personally are conscious. And this is kind of going to the simulation argument of the world. The only person I can know as conscious is myself. And everything else could be a simulation. This conversation could be a simulation in my consciousness, but I cannot prove that you are conscious. I can only prove that I am conscious. And I know that was a long-winded question, but let's opine on that a little bit.
Yeah, so can machines be conscious? I think the difference is it's not whether it's carbon or silicon. It's a concept of clearly machines can answer questions like a human can right now. We've passed the Turing test now many times. Arguably, can it think many, many steps ahead? Now, maybe a couple of steps ahead, a few steps ahead. Can it actually be aware of its existence, of its feeling? So I can, in fact, I've done this. I've got a digital twin. People can talk to my digital twin, and they can work on my digital twin, which will they can talk to it, and it looks like it's me. But does it feel like me? So to be able to know whether a being is conscious, it won't be something as simple as a Turing test, which merely tells you what is a no, does it behave like a human? You're going to have to talk to the machine and give it concepts that you would only know about and be able to intelligently articulate if you were alive. So there's something called the artificial consciousness test, where you have an artificial consciousness test and you give it questions that will only make sense if you were alive, if you had consciousness. So you might give it, have a discussion. You might actually have this interview, might be one of the some of the concepts we've talked about already, if you ask the machine about it. And you'd have to probably wall off the machine from the internet, so it can't look it up. And you'd probably also have to wall it off of some of the training data, so it doesn't interpolate. Maybe it trains on this interview and can guess what the answer should be. But you might have a discussion about reincarnation, now whether you believe it or not. But if you're not alive, it'll be a meaningless concept, reincarnation. You might have a discussion about a movie where someone switched from a 7-year-old to a 30-year-old. I forget the name of that movie, but I think it's Tom Hanks is in that movie. Again, if you're not alive, you might not be able to make any sense of what that means. From what does it feel like to switch? If you're 30 years old and you're now 7 years old, and vice versa, what does that feel like? If you're not alive, you may not be able to, you'll be able to answer, have some discussion, but it may not be a sensible, intelligent interaction. So there is a couple of schools of thought that right now GPT is a level of a single PhD in one topic. Can we get to superhuman, super intelligence? And some people think it's as early as 2029, where you have a computer that's as clever as a PhD in every topic. It really is surpasses all intelligence in all humanity to be able to optimize and provide new works completely beyond what humans can go about do at an accelerated pace. And at that point, is it a new species? Does it have feeling? We've sort of developed our ideas with respect to animal testing over the last few decades. Experiments that were done decades ago might be different to experiments done today, where there's much more inspection, where non-human primates, even dolphins, are given extra care on what experiments can be done versus a mouse. But even mice, there's more rules about what how animals should be treated in medical experiments. And certainly as you go down the animal hierarchy, they don't get as many privileges as non-human primates do. So people have started to think, this is not a sort of zero or one. There's a spectrum of aliveness, of consciousness, across the animal kingdom and across humans and machines. I'll stop there for a second so you can assimilate that.
Yeah, I think there's a risk, and this is kind of what we do right now, is entities or organisms, or an amalgamation of molecules or cells that are more similar to us, or we say they're more alive, or they're more conscious and more aware. And at the risk of maybe being a little bit not a little bit crass, maybe, if you define life and living by the ability to grow, adapt to stimuli, reproduce, and consume energy, cancer is arguably more alive than us. It grows faster, it consumes more energy, it reproduces faster. So I think when we get into these definitions of consciousness, awareness, and alive itself, I worry often we frame them with the lens of, are they like us? Do they look like us? Do they talk like us? Do we think they have empathy? And these are all very subjective terms. How do you think about defining these things by removing the human element? Do you think we will get to a better truth? And we have to be cognizant of the goal of maybe science and experimentation is to make our lives better. So there is a selfish goal there, and by our I mean the human species, our humankind's lives better. So we may get to an objective truth where and we kind of know this with climate change and the extinction of species, where the problem is us, right? Like we are the reason climate change is happening and so many species have gone extinct. But we have to take that knowledge and reframe it. Okay, how can we mitigate against these risks, but also improve humankind? And talk to me about how, when we make these definitions, should we just remove humanness from them and then bring it back at the end? Or should we continue looking at them through a human lens? And I'm being a bit pedantic here because I'm human. So I have to look at things through a human lens by definition.
Well, I don't think it has to be looked through a human lens. Like I said, like the artificial consciousness test, that's independent of being a machine or a human. There might be other paradigms. We know that machines do things better than humans already. They can calculate large numbers together. They can read books now quicker than us. They can actually come up with reasoning sort of quicker than us. They still make mistakes, just like we make mistakes. The question is, when we talk about intelligence, sometimes our people ask me, well, when will a machine become intelligent? Well, there are different types of intelligence, and if you look at it through the human scape. You might say these are intelligence, and these may be very difficult to apply to a machine. So there's IQ. We all know what IQ is, and that's machines are pretty good at IQ. They can bring up facts and they can do calculations, lightning speed, huge knowledge bases. But a very common term in the last few decades is EQ, emotional quotient. Are you interested in sitting next to this person for 12 hours on an aeroplane? Does this person have empathy? There's certain people who have great empathy with other people. They can sense when things are right and wrong, and maybe in the medical profession they sort of build up that in particular because they need to know the unwritten phenomena that are going on that the patient either doesn't want to tell or can't tell you or can't articulate it in a way that medicine needs to know to be able to treat the patient. But you know, that's really even at the simplest level, EQ. We have things like qualia, which is higher level moral codes, higher level emotions. So you can certainly, you know, use AI to detect when someone's happy or someone's sad. But what about envy or guilt? How would you do implement guilt mathematically, right? So from internal into the machine. So the machine might say, well, okay, I'm seeing things that are good that are happening in the world. So, for example, my existence as a machine, I'm helping lots of people answer lots of questions, but I'm using lots of energy. So it's sort of maybe a positive loop and a negative feedback. In control theory, in engineering, we call that control theory. It's very common where you're setting up motors and you want the motors not to spin too fast, but not to spin too slow and get enough energy, not to heat up, everything becomes even. That's what is different. But you know, IQ, EQ, that's just the basic levels. Now, the next thing is maybe AQ, right? So IQ, are you clever? EQ, are you willing to sit next to this person? Are they nice to be with? So they might meet those points. AQ is ambition quotient. So it's an autonomous thing where you want to drive ahead. So you might find someone who's clever and nice to be with, but they have no ambition. You know, they're shallow, right? And they don't want to drive anything or get anything done. But suppose you find that person and you get the machine that's autonomous, where machines don't have any ambition at the moment. As far as I can see, they have no ambition. We don't let them have any ambition. We just interact with them. They'll optimize a mathematical objective function, so they have no internal drive to get to the top, no matter what, to get to Mars, to build this, no matter what, even though it looks impossible. And sometimes you have to be in the space before you even know whether it's possible or not possible. So you've got AQ, and then you've also got you've got someone in that area. Then you've got CQ, compassion quotient, right? So you've got someone who's bright, brilliant, great to be with, fun to be with. They have ambition as well, but they have no compassion. They're completely selfless, selfish, completely selfish, right? And there's no sort of understanding of being compassionate to other people's needs and other things' needs. And then finally, you may have FQ, which is like freedom quotient, which is basically, are you going to do something surprising, sporadic? So in human terms, Richard, let me get on a plane and meet you tomorrow. Just decide to do that just now, right? Can a machine do that sporadically? Just think of something to surprise me, sparkle me. These are all sort of human attributes, and you could argue, well, do we care about any of them? Do we just simply care about the mathematical objective function of producing as much food as possible for the lowest cost? for the greatest number of people, or do we want higher order functions? And there is Maslow's hierarchy, which talks about, well, the basic function, can we just put food on the table? Can we put shelter on the table? And then once you've got those, well, then you say, well, am I appreciated by other people? Do I have status? If you can't put food on the table, you don't really care about your status. I I'll do anything. I'll do any job, anything you ask of me, just to get food on the table. And so we've got this hierarchy of intelligence, hierarchy of consciousness that fits across the different levels of machine development as these AIs coming up in the next few years.
I think it's clear to us that AI at this point, as you went into a little bit, does not have free will. It does not have that freedom coefficient. Do you think we have free will? I think that there's an argument that can be made that we make decisions based on our experiences and maybe the DNA we were born with, and that's kind of the end of that sentence. But what are your thoughts on free will, and do we possess it?
That's a very good question. I'm always asking my students that, and leaving aside the religious part of it, it's sort of like I think people naturally feel they do have free will, but I think there's a Sam Harris. I'm not sure if you're familiar with his work, but and it's sort of a controversial topic in a way. The thought that actually you may think you have free will, but you actually don't. You are actually just a product of your chemicals, and you're just a bag of chemicals, and you've had a set of experiences, and you have a certain set of DNA, and the experiences you have, the way you've brought up, really affect everything you're going to do, either on a minute by minute basis or on a macro, year by year basis. And you are not your own person. You may think you are, but you're not. That's one theory. It's controversial because it gives dictators and criminals and evil people a pass, because they're not evil. Just it's not their fault they're evil. It's just the way they were brought up and their experiences that they had. And that if you had the same experiences, you'd be evil too. So that's a controversial concept. So I think that clearly we are a product of our experiences. We view the world based on what we see. However, we are changeable. We see new experiences. We will decide to put ourselves in places where we listen to other views or not. If you are of a certain political ilk and you watch Fox News all the time and don't give PBS a chance, then you'll have a certain view continuing, and vice versa. If you just watch PBS all the time and you never watch Fox News, then you will never understand why the other half of the country or the planet doesn't see it the way you see it. And I think what's a little bit different to free will in a machine which doesn't have it is we actually move around. We actually are exposed to different things. And even if you do not watch Fox News, you do bump into other people, you bump into other thoughts and other areas in other fields. And so then you might start thinking, is there a point there? At least, can you understand why they think that, or think a particular that, why does the other side think the way they do? So I think there is, I think in general you have free will, but it's affected by your experiences. If you take the Chomsky view on language, humans have a unique ability to actually understand language, because we essentially have the ability to understand syntax and grammar programmed in at birth. And other animals don't have that, and that's why they can't have language. But clearly they do have language, but it's of a more limited version than ours.
I'm hesitating because I have a couple of questions, but I'm hesitating to see which one I should ask first. As humans, we have this inherent need, and I will use the word need, not desire, to group ourselves in tribes, and be it based on, race, religion, gender, intelligence, sports team, geography. And I would kind of put religion and maybe now political party at the extreme of this tribal association we place ourselves in. And extreme meaning we are not willing to reconsider our associations based on factual data. You can probably discern what I think about religion from this, but we'll leave that for another discussion. Why do you think we have this need? I think there's some good from it. It allows us to work together. It allows us to feel better. It allows us to have some more. If you look at people who have a lot of perseverance and grit, a lot of them have a faith that they rely on. They say, I'm doing this because of God, and it gives them a lot of power, to push through something, maybe to do good in this world, and sometimes to do a lot of bad in this world. If you want, if you're comfortable talking about religion, obviously, feel free to do so. But the question primarily is, why do you think we have this inherent need to organize ourselves in tribes, where it's like, right, we don't need to anymore. This our needs to live are taken care of. We have shelter, we have food, we have water. We don't have to be in packs and defend ourselves against lions or the woolly mammoth or whoever. So why do we persist with this need? And will AI have a similar need?
Yes, so I think you're right. We actually don't need, that's very, very pertinent. We don't need to be in tribes anymore for shelter or protection from at least wild animals, protection from each other by the sounds of it. We may do. I think that there is an individual streak. And if you ask a child, I think children. And certainly as a child, when I was a child, I couldn't really understand the concept of borders. Why can't you just walk, go wherever you want to go, go where you want to be,
I still
go,
don't.
cross the border. There are no borders if you're an individual organism. We're all the same. 99.5% of the DNA of all of us is the same. We're all the same, 99.5%. Actually higher than that actually, and yet there are societies, there's a societies, and I think there's much more globalization. If you play it forward, there's already more cosmopolitan communities within countries. If you looked 150 years ago, you looked at the country of Britain or country even the United States, which is an immigrant country. At the time, it was very homogeneous. Today, it is very cosmopolitan. And if you play it forward, I think Bill Clinton talked about this about a few decades ago. Eventually, you'll have the browning of America, where there'll be more people who are brown than not brown. The ability to travel from one place to another has extended that. Interracial marriages, people would be shocked by that 200 years ago, and now no one blinks. Or most people don't blink, at least. And then that's probably resulted again in religion being a sort of a core force hundreds of years ago, and it's still a force amongst many groups, but it's much less, I think, than hundreds of years ago. If you look at the macro trend, is likely to become less and less of a force. People may want to be attached to a religion. People may believe the concepts of a religion. It is a faith by definition, because as most of the religions have no evidence of the material that are is proposed, but there is a set of values, and often those values often are common to lots of religions, some variations, and maybe those values are not particularly religious values. The religions might take on those on board, but maybe those are human values rather than sort of intuitive human values rather than specifically religious values. I think no, well, people are looking at a more economic war rather than a tribal war right now. Are you willing to are you able to keep your standard of living as high as anyone else? If you look at economic theory, a couple of schools of thoughts: rising tides rise all boats, and if you can have trade, you can have different people, different groups, for depending on where what resources they have, adopt different strengths. So, if you happen to be lucky enough in a country that has lots of energy resources, you have that competitive strength. If you do not, then you have to maybe use your mind. And the idea, the competitive advantage of nations idea, is that each country sort of works itself out. Well, what's it good at? And they trade with each other. In my own way, I try not to do things that other people are good at. Let them do it. Let me find something that is not being done already, and start thinking about that. Can I do something that's new? The ability to have mobility is sort of turned things upside down. 200 years ago, basically a poor person today has travel opportunities, entertainment opportunities that a millionaire could only have 200 years ago. So the mobility and exposure, transmission of communication. We're talking to each other on a high quality video call for free, or practically free, which before you'd have a scratchy phone call at $1 a minute, pound a minute, euro a minute, and this is now free. And we're now seeing people interact with each other and exposed with each other, seeing how the other people live. The other half live. You almost have to sort of close your borders to stop people knowing what's going on. Whereas even as late as the 1970s, you had whole countries that really didn't know what life was like in the other country. You saw that in the breaking down of the Berlin Wall and the Cold War breaking down, where people in the Eastern Bloc said, wait, they've got supermarkets with 1,000 different, 40,000 things to buy. My supermarket has all the shelves are empty. Why? Right? Because they can just watch TV, they can watch movies, they can watch television shows and see how life is lived by other people. And they say, well, why can't we have this? So I think, and then similarly, if you're in a well-to-do environment, you see, why are people in this world, when we have so much, why are people suffering? Why can't we organize ourselves to get food on the table? Right? Why can't people figure out a solution to their land wars? Maybe the solution in the future won't be land wars, but will be AI wars, computing wars. Who's got the cleverest AI system? I'll stop there for a second to let you.
Yeah, I guess is the theory that we are organizing ourselves in tribes because of economic resources and our need to compare ourselves with others and want more and more.
Well,
Yeah.
definitely we do organize it, not just as countries, but as companies. I mean, that's why companies exist, to organize themselves. They're not considered as countries, to organize themselves to offer a solution to a problem that hasn't been solved. And you need a certain set of people for a certain type of problem. And so this sense of organizing, it seems to be inherent to human culture, not just particularly for the tribal base, but to get things done. And companies in the future may be stronger than countries. Maybe that's already the case. There's a TV series, I'm not sure if anyone remembers it. It was on the Sci-Fi Channel. I think it was called Incorporation. It's set in 2070, and climate change has hit. And they finally do build a wall, but it's a wall on the Canadian border to stop Americans emigrating to Canada because the climate, the US has turned into a desert. And yeah, if you're lucky enough to work for a big tech company, there was like six or seven big tech companies who basically commandeered all functions of society in particular areas. You were living quite a comfortable life. But if you were not, you'd be grasping at straws and being a supplier or a servant or a nursemaid to the people who did work in those companies. And those companies would tell the countries what to do instead of the other way around. Right now, we as countries tell companies what to do, and we'll stop them doing things or encourage them to do things based on our policies as a country. If you, in this world, and it may happen, it may be that companies tell governments what to do. And it may be the AIs that those companies run tell those companies what to do and what to tell the governments to do to optimize for particular functions. And it may not just be profit.
What are the other functions that they would optimize for? I would think profit and shareholder value is what they would want. And this future sounds bleak to me. I'm not sure if I would have religion around the world or companies, because in one of them, at least charity is mandated. And both of them, ethics are subjective and malleable. What are, and let's not harp on religion too much, but do
Well,
you see this as a positive that the companies will run the world?
companies is not just profit, it is also existence. It's well known that companies that sometimes may make too much profit, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. Because if there's too much profit being made, other companies come in and try and compete because there's so much profit to be made. They try and compete and create the same product. So things sort of mediate. And so you'd optimize for existence. Some companies, and if you look at the companies of the 20th century or even 19th century, were actually quite paternalistic. Some companies set up values for their employees. So their employees would be sometimes equally hired. They would offer company stores, they'd offer company housing, company cars, everything for the employees. But make no mistake, it was for the benefit of the company, the ephemeral company shareholder, not for pure charity. But it would appear as an altruistic viewpoint that if we make our employees happy, then we make good products. But they didn't have to be altruistic. You just say, we need to make our employees happy. We need to keep them fed. We need to have them get health care so they keep working. Not just, I mean, we don't want them to be well just for the sake of it. We want them to be well so they can continue to be our workers. And you can argue whether today's companies, and certainly today's companies, a couple of decades old, you've got a few companies here that's still a century old, right? IBM maybe one of them, General Motors, Ford. They're usually not the top companies of today, but they do exist, and they seem to exist. They have a recipe built in internally, these 100-year-old companies built in internally to continue to exist. Having said that, a lot of companies have gone away. Gone away, some of them have gone away completely, some or a shadow of their former selves. If we look at Kodak, if we look at Polaroid, they still exist just, but they're a shadow, no, 100th, 1/100th of their former selves. And is that going, if you look at history, that tends to what happens. These big companies don't stay. There's upstarts, and this goes back to the economics, the competitor level. And maybe the governments have been putting that so-called antitrust laws to stop companies becoming overarchingly dominant to in particular industries or whole industries. So I think I agree with you. It is a bleak situation if the companies are optimized for their own being, because it may not be optimized for human, really optimized for this ephemeral entity, right? Which may not even be okay for their employees, right? It's but they might be positioned as this is the optimum for the employees, for the shareholders that own the company, and for society, they might say too, because this is usually the argument in biotech. We need to have patents because we need to have protection once we invent something, that we can get money for the investment we made in inventing that system.
There is a view, specifically mostly in the VC community, but also in part of the AI community, that AI will usher an era of abundance where humans will no longer have to work. This requires that we take care of the humans who don't have to work, which there doesn't seem to be a plan to do that. What are your thoughts on will AI usher an era where humans don't have to work? And then what are some predictions as if that is true, are we going to be happier as a society or without the, because we get quite a bit of our purpose and meaning from work. And maybe there's a false dichotomy here where this is more common in the male phenotype, whereas meaning can come from relationships and other avenues, which sounds better. What are your thoughts on meaning and purpose in life? Where does it come from for you, maybe? Whereas where do you think it should come? For me, it comes from, when I think about where I drive the most meaning from and purpose, oftentimes it's my career. I don't want it to be my career. I want it to be my family and friends. But my inherent programming is the other way, and I've been working for the past, I would say 5 years when I recognize this, to try and change it, and I'm failing. So where does meaning and purpose come for you? Will AI usher an era of abundance? And if it does, will we be happier as a society, and will we take care of the people who don't have work in that era?
Right, so I'm optimistic. So first of all, AI will usher an era of abundance. It will create lots of new ideas, lots of reduction of grunt work and speeding up of ideas, acceleration of production. So there's a couple of theories here. This is the lump of labor theory, and this is the argument that basically, okay, if you have machines that take over some work or some, even something else that goes away, the work goes away, there's nothing for those people to do. There's only a finite set of work to be done. And if you take away some of the work to be done by a machine or it be done by something else and doesn't need to be done, then then the work gets smaller. And that certainly could be the case that, the works get smaller and smaller, and then people This is called the basic income theory, where people just get given a check. It's not that the society does worse because stuff is still being produced, but people are given a check to every month to live on and buy things. I actually think it's going to be the opposite. I think there's humans have an insatiable desire to have new desires, new products, new things to do, and that is practically infinite. And it's only limited by their lack of time because they're doing other things and doing their existing forms of work. So it's a bit like bandwidth. No matter how much bandwidth you have, it gets filled up. So this is like this. No matter how much free time you have, you'll fill it up, right? So work expands to fill the time available. So if all of a sudden all the grunt work is now done by a machine, that leaves up new time for you to do more things. Also gives you new time for you to desire more things. And other people will create systems to meet those desires. And guess what? They will have machines to help them create them. They'll have AI to help them. This is the golden age of invention about to appear. It used to be you were limited by resources, either energy resources, physical resources, tools, or in later years, skills. Can you code? And the skills are now going to be encoded in machines. It's now going to be a golden age of creativity. People who thought they weren't creative will become creative. It will be a new sort of educational kind of era where, it's already a bit like this. And, you don't go to university to learn, you go to university to learn how to learn, right? Because the technology, the knowledge is obsolete within several, within a year or two, particularly in science and technology, but even in the humanities, new ideas, new thoughts, new frameworks pop out. And so if you come to with the new approaches, there'll be just, a million new entrepreneurs, billion new entrepreneurs, a billion new ideas exploding on the scene. Not limited to by the fact they can't program, not limited they don't have a machine at home, they can log into the cloud and have those tools done for them. And so that's the optimistic view. So I actually don't think we're going to get to a world where people just sit at home and get a check. I think that will be a backdrop, a fallback. But I think people are going to take that opportunity and do things they want to do.
I wish for that future as well. And I think the caveat being is so the thought is that people would do things they want to do and there will be a market for those services. And that's how they will make money to pay for their expenses. Or do
Yeah,
you
and
think
that
that we need to?
there could be a time shift. It could be a shift where it's not actually quite matched in time, where people are not, it's a sort of a shock to the system that, who do I work for now? Oh, well, actually, no one's got any work for you to do. You work for yourself now, right? It's sort of a shift in type of education and type of mindset. Where it may be actually going back to eras of hundreds of years ago where you didn't have big conglomerate employers, except for maybe the government or, armies and people like that, where you have sort of lots of small artisans and everyone's got their own sort of advantage and or sort of specialism too. But it could be on a bigger scale because, you can distribute your products worldwide. It used to be if you wrote some software, you had to find a publisher and you'd have to they'd put it in a box and put it in the shops, and now you can get it to a billion people just by uploading it onto one of the phone platforms. A billion people, but guess what? A million other companies can do that too. So everyone can do it, but the actual getting to the person to find things is not as big an issue if you actually want it. If you write a book, you publish a book, you can self-publish now. It used to be you got a traditional publishing model with lots of publishers who try and get it in the bookstores, and you still have those somewhat, but it's now a little bit more level playing field where you can just write your book and stick it on the Amazon store for people to use.
The concept of digital reality versus physical reality is very interesting from a sense of what is truth and what is not true, or what is falsehood. We can prove physical reality to be true or not true by various things. And maybe a couple examples is, did this tree fall? Well, was there a tree there before and did it fall? Like you can see it fell. If it's fallen there currently, even if it's not fallen currently, maybe there's people saw a tree there, there's evidence in the soil, there's roots. There are things that you can go back in time and prove beyond a shadow of a doubt. And you know, I use that phrase as much as we can, that this happened in physical reality, or this is happening right now. Digital reality is very different. You know, without going into blockchain, perhaps, and that technology hasn't been adopted, so it's not part of our digital reality at scale right now. There is a worry that AI will say, make a fake study to sell a placebo medication, and maybe even make a fake journal. And as long as everything lives digitally, AI can write, or we can digitally alter the truth. Before we couldn't, because we did not have the technology to make videos realistic, audios realistic. But now we can have a video of someone doing something from 50 years ago, and you know, punish them for a crime, and then to extrapolate that, you can get into this Minority Report scenario where you're predicting crimes that are actually made up by AI. Because you want someone behind bars, because maybe, you know, maybe they work for Facebook and you're Google, right? And this world where companies rule the world, they also have the ability to change our reality, both the past, the present, and the future. How do you kind of think about that? Are we giving AI too much power? You know, one of my clinics still uses paper and pen. And maybe we should keep it that way. At least there's proof that this is what happened in this encounter, and then there's no way to alter that. And you
Well,
can, yeah.
yeah, so we're going to be entering a world, and we're a third of the way in that world already, where anything digital, you're actually not going to believe. This is going to be like that. So, fine, yeah, AI can fake something, you can fake something. You're going to get back to the world of endorsed, curated curators, either by professions. Where you say, well, I can go to the AI doctor, but who wrote, who's behind this AI doctor? So that's where a real doctor may still have a role. You're going to get to the level where maybe you need to buy airline stocks, hotel stocks, because even DocuSign, even a video call, we won't believe anymore. We actually have to physically meet you. Talk to you, shake your hand in the flesh, and see you sign with ink on a piece of paper to know we can get the deal done. To have the physical ability. So anything digital will have its, so you're going to have to. This is where, like, the New York Times, all the newspapers who went out of business or got diminished over the last 40 years, may have come back with a play where we No, I see something on the internet, on Twitter, on Meta, or what have you. It's not curated. Could be anybody. But if it's the New York Times website, okay, I might agree or disagree with bits of the New York Times, but at least I know it's them, right? And therefore, these curators are going to come up. And their job is to stop themselves being copied and deep faked, of course. And there'll be a number of ways they can do that. But you're going to see that there's going to be, actually, ironically, this, and we saw this in when computers came about. We thought there'd be no paper needed anymore, then the amount of paper would be reduced. In fact, the amount of paper went up. And maybe this is also going to happen with AI. We think, well, actually, everything's going to be digital now. We won't need to do anything, meet anyone anymore. It will just do all the work for us. But actually, maybe we'll need actually more human bonding as a result of this. You know, we keep complaining about teenagers, well, not just teenagers, even adults, you know, glued to their phones. But if you, as you see AI doing more and more stuff, no, as it becomes more functional, but then if you actually have to do a transaction, you have to do a contract, maybe that'll increase human person-to-person communication. Also, digital's just boring. You know, it's much more fun to have a cup of coffee with you than you have even this Zoom call. It'd be more fun to do it in person than to have a sort of email. There's a hierarchy of, you know, texting, email, video call, also a phone call, video call, and then in person, right? So in person, you say, well, I haven't got time to go and do meet every single person one at a time, but can we meet them in scale, which is where you do a podcast in this kind of issue and have sensible interactive discussion.
As part of what you do right now, you invest in startups. Tell me a bit about how do you think about structure versus intuition? How do you think about a purely correlation-based strategy? And, you know, maybe we can go back to the Rentec model of investing, where I think my audience probably knows this already, but Jim Simons came up with this model called the Medallion Fund, and they invested purely based on correlation data. And they took out the human element. So if the algorithm said invest in this startup, you invest in it. You don't. There's no investment memo. There's nothing else. It's just the algorithm says it, and you test the algorithm. So I think there's a Quantum Light is a new fund by the Revolut founder who's trying to do this. What are your thoughts on could and you know, there's obvious reasons why it can't be because we don't get feedback right away. There's just too many unknowns. The public markets are very different. You get feedback almost instantly if you made the right decision. And if you borrow Danny Kahneman's framework of where to rely on validity versus intuition. Overdrive was in on structure versus intuition. This is something where, you know, you can't have just correlation-based intuition. What are your thoughts on structure versus intuition? How much of VC is just correlation, investing in startups, and how much is intuition?
Well, first of all, keyword is correlation, not causation, right? So, when I've seen some of these quantitative models in VC, often I found really they're just following expert investors. They end up just investing in things that Sequoia invested in, right? And usually, but that's usually later. So if you're, you know, we invest at the very earliest stages. So we invest in AI and longevity science companies, and we invest at the very early stages, first check, often only check, probably the riskiest point, the riskiest of the riskiest point. And certainly, much of VC is pattern matching recognition. You've seen this story before, seen this playbook before, you've seen this playbook in one area, can it be applied in a different area? And that's often, that's sort of the Uber story, the Uber of cat feeding, the Uber of dog walking. This is like Uber, people will talk about that. You take one business model, apply it to a different segment, and often that can work. And I'd say that's a correlation kind of thing. When you're doing deep science, or moonshot science, and venture still plays in that. Does play in that. It almost That's almost the definition of venture, because if it's building another coffee shop, that's not venture. We know how the coffee shop economics. We know that people want to drink coffee. We know what a successful cafe looks like. We just build it. No, location is probably a big impact in coffee shop business, and maybe put a different model. You want to have chains of coffee shops, and where you put them in the right place. This is a Starbucks model. In deep science venture, where I play in, the science often, a lot of investors will say, "Well, I don't want to invest in it because I don't understand it." Well, guess what? No one understands it. That's why it's called deep science. If it was science that people understood, they'd just call it science. If it's deep science, no one understands it. So you're going to have to roll your sleeves up and get the intuition first of all. So it will be intuition. Is there a there to think about and to play in that area? And are you willing to spend the time as an investor to roll your sleeves up to understand what the venture is about? Now, the other view is don't bet on the horses, but bet on the jockey instead. Right? So you just assume the jockey has chosen the right horse, chosen the right race to run in, and that can work too. So some people will invest in a company. We're investors, but we're also inventors. I'm an inventor. Now, one of my most interesting ideas to work on a moonshot is a vaccine. A vaccine for what, you may ask? A vaccine for aging. So wait, how does that work? No, and who's crazy enough to even try that, right? And well, maybe Ron John's one of those people. Where when in 1983, he was working on a machine that could transcribe speech. This is 1983. We said we're going to make a machine that can understand speech. And that concept at that point was only seen in science fiction. And
Let's go deeper on the vaccine for aging. Tell me a little bit more about how you're thinking about that. How do you think about aging? I'm assuming there are some parts of aging that are beneficial for us, and some parts that aren't. In a lot of ways, the memories we form, or brain, if you want to call it aging to an extent, is good. We want to be wiser, smarter, more intelligent, make better decisions, not be as driven by our emotions to an extent, especially when the lead is astray. But bodily aging beyond a certain point, we want to stop. How do you think about aging? How do you break it down? And how do you kind of control to only target the bad parts of aging, without the good parts?
exactly correct. So aging's not all bad. We get wiser. We actually don't get as reactive as we are when you're younger. We don't have, dollar reactions to nickel problems. Younger people often get upset about simpler things, and as you get older, you've seen it all before, and you're maybe a bit calmer. We just know more. We just know more as each year you know more. You know more people. You know more things, and then you want to protect your brain from neurodegenerative diseases. So, one thing about aging, as the way we look at it at Agemica, which is the company that is trying to do an aging vaccine, that's AGEMICA, is. That there are many diseases that are age related that increase in prevalence as you get older. And an aging concept is almost opposite to another concept known as personalized medicine. Right, so in aging, we're trying to find solutions that fix lots of things all at once. Personalized medicine is often trying to fix one thing that only affects you. Right, so they do sort of overlap as well because you can sort of scale personalized medicine ideas. But the way we look at aging is think of it as clusters of diseases. So, three big clusters are cardiovascular, the number one killer. Second one is cancer. And the third one is neurodegenerative. So, if we can solve those three, that will give you a very big chunk of a lot of age-related diseases. And they actually are correlated as well. If you solve one, and then the others improve as well. And what we want to do is use the power of the tools of the day, which are different than the tools of even 5 years ago. Can we protect proteins from being disrupted and turned into cancer cells? Can we sort of realize that the central dogma theory that we all have DNA? What's amazing is the DNA is the same in every single cell of ours, whether it's a tongue cell or a stomach cell. And DNA turns into RNA. RNA creates proteins, and the proteins tell our cells what to do. And then when we get older, that regulation seems to disrupt a little bit. Can we stop that happening? Can we program peptides to protect proteins from turning into cancerous, but not turning our normal cells into disruptive components at the same time? So how do you sort of kill bad cells without killing normal cells? And with AI, you have a new tool available to you. So that's what we're trying to do at Agemica. And we think we have a prototype for a aging vaccine, an mRNA aging vaccine. We think we can solve at this point about 30 cancers all at the same time. So a pan-cancer vaccine, think about it cluster by cluster, and then thinking about rinsing and repeating, taking the same idea and use the same technique for the other clusters of diseases. And aging, if you can solve even big chunks of it, all of a sudden society's medical problems go away. All these problems about not enough doctors, not enough nurses, paying $100,000 for a cancer treatment. Well, if you don't get cancer, you don't need to pay for it. If you don't get cancer, you don't need to see the doctor. Nature's come out with a study. If you can solve aging, it's a $38 trillion impact. Think of a big idea and thinking of the tools available to you, and then jumping into the space is one of the ideas. If you don't jump into the space, well, it won't happen. So, what space do you want to jump into? So that's certainly the space, and then you put some money to work at it in it, and try and do it step by step. So in the old speech recognition days, when I couldn't, I said I'm going to make a machine to transcribe speech. I said, well, okay, let's break it down. Let's just do telephone digits to start off with, and then later on, 15, 18 years later, it's on everyone's phones, full speech transcription. So I think about aging science. Okay, well, aging is a big problem. There's many, many age-related diseases. Let's start with cancer. Cancer is a good one to look at because it's, as you know, it metastasizes. So if you solve one cancer, it's too late. You've got another cancer. And so can you solve groups of diseases at the same time? And so that was a good model to look at. And then can we solve that model in the other models? So there we have it. So that's the moonshot I'm working on. And sometimes I say, I encourage people, Richard, what's your big idea? That's my big idea. There are loads of big ideas to work on. And then think about how the big idea can be worked on. And instead of saying, giving up before you even start, saying, well, how do we break the problem down? That's the engineer in me coming. I'm an engineer, where we would be pragmatic and say, well, how do we break the problem down?
Yeah, I think from a medicine care delivery perspective, the problems aren't technical. The problems are regulatory and reimbursement. We can create an AI physician that's completely autonomous for specific verticals from a technical perspective tomorrow. For to refill birth control, blood pressure medications, these are very fairly straightforward clinical decision trees. Some of them are more robust than others, but I can probably write a clinical decision tree for a blood pressure refill in a day or two. And it might be a comprehensive, but I can do it. I'm sure someone can code it. But no state medical board is going to give that clinical decision tree a license to actually refill the birth control. And no
Yeah,
payer is going to
today,
reimburse that
today,
today.
today.
Today, yeah.
Yes.
So the question becomes, do I build it now and wait? Because venture as a, and in building a company, you have to pay employees. There's a time, there's a stopwatch that starts when I start this. And how long do I wait before I build this? So last question, Ron, if you could go back in time and talk to your 20-year-old self, or maybe if you could go back in time 10 years ago, what piece of advice would you tell 20-year-old Ron John and then Ron John 10 years ago?
Yes. So 20-year-old Ron John, I think, is have a thick skin, expect rejection, and show up. 99% of life is just showing up. So all you have to do, I've been rejected so many times for so many things. But over time, you get thicker. The skin got thicker and thicker and thicker. Didn't worry about it. But in the early days, it was quite unnerving when you got rejected for something. But apply for things and show up to things. Talk to people. Don't be afraid. Go out of your comfort zone. 10 years ago, it would be. I think go out of your comfort zone is still there. I think I'd got used to being rejected, so not a problem. In fact, the more you got rejected, the more you wanted to do it. Actually, I think that's almost a positive sign. The more people say you can't do it, the more you actually say, well, you can do it. You can do it, and you are going to do it. But try and be also as humble as you can. I think I sort of rolled into it in trying to be factual and be available to people and just have no airs and graces. I think that's probably general theme is just be accessible. If someone wants to talk to you, talk to them, and be able to think bigger. Probably also think bigger. My 10 years ago, I'd say think bigger. So I'm thinking big now, and looking back, I was thinking big, I guess, 20, 30 years ago, but I didn't feel like I was, right? So. I think there's lots and lots of big ideas and lots of now role models and people who have done big ideas. And so you think, well, why can't I? Why can't you? There's other the resources now available to people, no
That's
matter where
great
you.
advice. Yeah, don't be afraid of rejection and think bigger. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me, Richard.